I've been on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. I've been on the low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Project Mayday. As you can see, I have Bree's better half here today. Zeph, welcome back. And today we have Trey White. He is a battalion chief with Burbank Fire Department. 20 plus years in the fire service. Thank you for that service, Chief. And a little unique thing about Trey is it's a little different where his home life actually was brought into his work life. And that's a little different because it's the other way around usually. So he's got a story where, you know, his daughter was involved in a mass casualty incident, active shooter, and he will absolutely talk all about that. And you'll hear his story from the humble beginnings of Compton to where he is now as a battalion chief in Burbank. So, Trey, welcome.
Hey, fellas, thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you. So, Chief, let's get right on it. Let's talk about your childhood, how you grew up. Did you play any sports, anything along those lines?
Yeah, I grew up in South LA. I was born and raised there. I did play sports when I was about 13 or so. Me and my mom, we moved out to Cerritos, where I pretty much did my high schooling. Playing a lot of basketball, a little bit of football, a little bit of baseball growing up. And, you know, right after high school, my mom got remarried, and we ended up in Compton, where I kind of cut my teeth a little bit in the fire service. And this is kind of where I started.
Awesome. So what brought you into the fire service? Did you know right out of high school that that's what you wanted to do? Did somebody bring you into it?
No. So it's an interesting question that you asked me, Zeph, is that I was in college and kind of screwing around in college, changed my major a bunch of times, you know, and I was a senior at Long Beach State, and my stepdad at the time asked me if I ever thought about being in the fire service. And I told him, no. I said, actually, I thought about being a cop. And it didn't work out for me, so that's kind of a good thing. Not to say anything bad about those guys, but I just got lucky, you know. And so he said, well, why don't you think about it? I went home, I thought about it, and he said, hey, go over here to the Compton Fire Station and talk to this guy. And just so happened that my stepdad ended up going to high school with half of the Compton Fire Department back then. And so I talked to a guy. And I started playing basketball with them on a regular basis, getting to know them. And literally, I think 6 months after I talked to the first guy, I was in a private fire academy run through the Compton Fire Department. 7 months later, I graduated. And 9 months after, or 2 months after that, I was a reserve. And that was kind of what springboarded me into the fire service. Interesting fact, and I didn't, and I just thought about this, is that when I grew up in South LA, literally about five or six houses down the street from me, was a family that I was really close and still am close with, the Leon family. And Job Leon was a Captain 2 for LA City Fire Department. His next brother in line, and there was five of them, so four boys and a girl. And the next brother in line, Rudy, who is still active as a LA County firefighter paramedic, 35 years. And then the youngest brother, Mike, who is my age, is a paramedic for LA City. So that little 2100 block of that neighborhood produced four firefighters. So
wow. So, you know, let's back up a little bit to, you know, you said you played sports and whatnot. Did that have anything to do with you swaying from being a police officer to being a firefighter? Like, what was the, you said, you know, you were posed, you wanted to be a police officer, and then you were like, nah, you know what, I'm going to go this way. What was the swaying factor?
There was a couple things. So, there was two agencies that I was interested in, and one of them was the Highway Patrol, and the other one was the LA County Sheriff's Department. And the two drawbacks for that, the CHP was that I had to move to Sacramento and be there for 7 months, and then there was no guarantee where they were going to place me if I was going to be close enough back to my home unit. So that was kind of ruled it out. And then with the county sheriffs at the time, and this is, remember, this is back in the early 90s, early mid-90s, you were doing custody for about 7 years. So you're working in the jails for about 7 years prior to you being out in the field. So that didn't really appeal to me either. So I think that the fire service was kind of in my destiny, and I just didn't know it at the time until I was really asked that question by my stepfather, and it kind of set me on the path.
Nice. And, you know, we've spoke outside of, you know, doing this, where you said that you, when you were going through the whole process, you know, becoming an EMT, going to Fire Academy, you know, going and doing all these interviews, there was a certain interview that happened where you had said, they had asked you a question of how do you feel about kids or, you know, pediatrics in general, or those calls. And you, you know, you said you, that was kind of like your weakness. So, right. And then they responded with something that, I mean, I haven't heard of anybody responding with, you know, so what era was that? Where were you, you know, where were you at? And, you know, kind of just tell us about that.
Yeah. So when I was a reserve, the good thing about the reserve program in Compton was that it was a mentorship. And so, they would train us, you know, we worked, you had to do 3 24-hour days of shifts a month. And so that was kind of cool. I got to play fireman on the weekend, basically. And, you know, and it was good, man. And so they would also put you through mock interviews, making sure you were good and really tighten you up for the testing process, which is great. And so, you know, they ask you a question about what's your weakness, and, you know, my weakness are kids. And they were like, well, you can't have that as a weakness. You have to find something else. Well, here we are, you know, 23 years later, and it turns out that kids are my weaknesses.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And I tell guys and I tell people that all the time. It's okay for kids to when you see them go through pain and trauma, it's okay for it to affect you. You just have to manage that effectiveness.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, 2021 is probably better put, instead of saying, you know, kids can't be your weakness. It should be, you know, it's okay that kids are your weakness, but you still need to be able to function appropriately and render proper treatment to that kid, you know, when he's in his hour of need. And then, you know, afterwards we could talk about it and work through it, kind of a deal. But as opposed to saying, no, man, kids can't be your weakness. That's not practical, I don't think.
Yeah. No. And it turns out that, you know, when I got into the fire service, you had to hold on to that those types of calls didn't bother you. And we were not very good in the beginning of my career about dealing with those things. And it turns out that I've, over my course of my career, I had, on three separate incidents, well, I had three kids die. It totally affected me. And I had no idea that it was affecting me, up until, probably a little bit before this, but right around the active shooter at my middle daughter's high school.
Mm-hmm. And you say that, you know, you back then it was frowned upon or whatever the case may be to not speak about kid, you know, what you're feeling on kid calls. And you said, you know, those were one of your highest level, you know, calls that where you were affected the most. Put yourself back into your younger fireman days and how could you have handled that situation better when, you know, you had those kid calls and you wanted to bring it up, but you couldn't?
Well, courage obviously is one of the biggest things. And then, you know, in the fire service, I haven't been in a long time, but I've been in a long enough time to see where we were as a service and where we are, especially with your show, where we are now. And so back then, you didn't really talk about it. You didn't have the opportunity to. So it was almost if you were too weak to do the job. So my advice to myself back then is it's okay to be vulnerable. And even as a chief officer, I think strong leadership shows some vulnerability. It's okay to admit when you're wrong. It's okay to show some feeling and just know that you are a human being and you're just not a robot, you know? So if, you know, my advice to myself was to have the courage it's okay to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And what's vulnerable? What is vulnerability to you?
Vulnerability to me is just really letting your guard down and not being able to tell people how you actually feel about certain things. And, you know, you're not holding that in. You have an outlet, whether it be somebody at home, somebody at work, a combination of both, somebody professional. But that's okay to know that, you know, we are fixers in the fire service. And sometimes the fixers need fixing ourselves.
Yeah,
that's true.
Absolutely. So now let's fast forward a little bit to when you had your fatality fires. And for those that are listening that don't know what that means, is that Chief White went into a building to try to rescue somebody and they ended up passing in the burning building. So describe that feeling, you know, put yourself back in that those moments and explain to us, you know, the history of Burbank Fire Department with fatalities. And then also you were on, I think, all of them or most of them. So describe that.
Well, I can only speak for the time that I've been there. So my first one was, I was pretty new on the job, maybe 2 or 3 years on. And I remember it like it was today. It was a detached garage fire that had been converted to a living space. And I remember getting there, and there was a gentleman in the back who was burned beyond recognition. He was curled up in the fetal position pretty close to the door. And I just remember the senior guys just kind of, you know, making light of the situation, which we kind of did in the fire service as a coping mechanism, right? And so obviously I didn't really know what to think about that. And just kind of, I think I suppressed those feelings. And then as a chief officer, probably about 7 or 8 months ago, we had a fatality fire kind of similar to the first one. And it was at that fire and after that fire was over that I realized that I was still suffering from the first one. You know, I had some PTSD based on that. I had no idea about it until this fire happened. And so, I'm going to try to make it quick, but there's kind of a backstory to this, to the second fire. So the second fire was another detached garage fire. And it was right behind our city credit union. So this gentleman, in the second fire, always hung out in this garage. And anytime you entered to the credit union, you had to go out the alley where his garage was. So either you made a right out of the alley or a left. And if you made a right, you drove past him. If you made a left, you looked at him before you drove the other way. And so I knew who this guy was. I didn't know him personally, but for over 20 years, I had seen this gentleman inside of his garage. And so the fire went into a second operational period because of the fatality. And so basically at 7 a.m., we had a shift come in and relieve us on duty. And I gave them some leader's intent and really some advice. I basically told them, hey, do yourself a favor. If you don't got to go look at the guy, don't go look at the guy. And I remember a couple guys afterwards saying, hey, yeah, that was the best advice that you could have given me. And so what I did was that I felt bad that I didn't want the men and women who worked for me on that shift to go through what I went through 20 something years earlier and suppress those feelings. And so, I looked for an outlet and for a debrief for them. And because my shift was so short, I have a lot of members from different shifts coming in. So basically I got we have a mental health professional, in the city that a lot of our members are in tune with. And, I got in contact with her through management and we were able to set up, basically a 3-shift debriefing. And I was able to start that debriefing by being vulnerable and giving them my story of why they were there. And I said, I don't know if this is the correct form, but I don't know if you don't want to be here, if you want to be here, but we required everyone to go. And, I told them that if I got to one person today, then I did my job as a chief officer.
And it's interesting you say that, you know, you were the one that came out and said, hey, we need to talk about this we need to do a stress debrief, because that's not always the case on a lot of, you know, debrief or a lot of critical incidents like a fatality fire. So I commend you for going out of, you know, your way and being vulnerable. Did you get the response that you were hoping that you would get by being the example of, you know, being vulnerable and you coming out to the guys, be like, hey, come on, or, you know, and gals, hey, talk to me.
Yeah, I did. You know, a little bit selfish. It was kind of cathartic for me too. But I had a lot of people, come to me afterwards and tell me, hey, that was a good job, that we needed that. And just to, my agency has gone away from the critical incident stress debriefing model, and we've gone into more of a peer team with a identify, I think we have about 20 or 30 members on the department that are identified as peer team members. And it's actually denoted by their name on our daily schedule. So we know that if you have a PR next to your name, these people are peer teams and you can call them at any time. But I even had people in there who I thought would not open up, who did open up. So when I saw that happen, I knew that we were on the right path, even though it was more of a debrief. And that's something that we're kind of going away from. But I think it was very beneficial for the people who were there.
So, Chief, we spoke about it in the intro. We said that your case was a little unique about how your home life affected your work life with the shooting with your daughter. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, a little backstory?
So November 14th, 2019. I was at work. It was my first shift. We work at 4896. And that was a unique day just because, and a couple of reasons, not only because of the shooting, but I work for a small agency where we have six battalion chiefs and the fire chief. And that was the day of a JAC conference. And so we had the deputy chief, two battalion chiefs, and the fire chief were down in Palm Springs of a conference. And the only remaining members who could work the line or in operations were myself, who was coming on the B shift battalion chief that I relieved that morning, and the A shift chief who lives well over an hour. Actually, both of them live well over an hour away from the agency. I was sitting at the coffee table, and my daughter called me, and she never calls me. We text, and she said, "Dad, they're shooting," and I felt helpless at the time and didn't really know what to do because I'm 40 minutes away from home and I can't leave because I can't walk into the deputy's office or into the fire marshal's office and say, "Hey, can you cover me while I go home?" And she kind of jokes with me about it, but I think she might be a little bit upset because I told her, "Hang up and call your mother," because we only live 5 minutes from the school. And then at that point I was really helpless. And so all the command staff are on a group chat, group text. And so I put it out, "Hey, there's a shooting at my daughter's school. I need to go home." Nothing. And so that really just spun me up a little bit more. So then I called the guy that I relieved that morning, who had only been gone for about 40 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. He didn't answer the phone. So now I'm really helpless. And now I can't figure out what to do. So eventually the deputy ended up calling me and said, "Hey, go ahead home, put the," and I think at this time, we're probably about 15 or 20 minutes now after she called me. And obviously where I live, there's a lot of cops and firemen that live here, a lot. I mean, it's a ton. And at the conference, news was starting to spread through the conference. So, people were realizing that what I was telling them was accurate. And so the deputy called me and goes, "Hey, don't worry about it. Put it out of service. We've already contacted the neighboring agency because in our system we run, there's 13 cities dispatched by one dispatch center. And there's no border. So, hey, the next battalion chief's going to cover the city. Go ahead and take off, go home." So that was very tragic in and of itself. I still have a hard time with that. And, it wasn't a good day. Luckily my daughter was unhurt, but unfortunately she's forever hurt because she was standing, less than 10 feet from the kid who shot. Luckily she had her back to him and, but it's something that the family has been affected by greatly and that we are still working through, all of us here. And it haunts us every day.
Yeah, and we appreciate you sharing your story, Chief, and your daughter's story for that fact. As firefighters and, police officers and whatnot, we're getting there after the fact. And so you got that call while she was in it. And so, it takes about 8 minutes roughly to get there. And then, you said it was about 20 minutes since the call. And so we're already behind the curve. and you're already behind the curve of, okay, like my daughter's there. It's already been 20 minutes or, you know, I'm sure that you were analyzing the whole situation in your mind about, you know, when we should have got there, what's going to happen. The shooter's already been shooting and all that. You know, I know you're getting emotional and I know it's tough to talk about, but talk about the actual feeling that you got when you hung up the phone with her after you said, hey, call your mom. What was that feeling?
Helpless. I remember sitting at the table saying, sorry, fellas. Just saying there's a shooting at my daughter's school and everyone is kind of looking at me like I was lying, you know, or I was kidding. And then news reports start coming on and then I get up and walk away from the table because I got to start making phone calls and trying to figure it out. And then I called her back and she doesn't answer the phone. I call my wife and she's like, she's not answering the phone because she's trying to get to my daughter. And, so there's a lot of emotion and really a feeling of helplessness, in and of that fact, because she called the hero. She called her dad, right? I'm the person supposed to keep her safe and save her. But my only response to her was to call your mother because I couldn't do what I needed to do. And that eats me up every day. That 2020 outside the pandemic was extremely difficult for the White family. And, we had to put my daughter on two separate, 5-day holds, voluntary holds. And of course, the first time, we had to put her on a hold, my wife calls me on a Sunday and we don't, I shouldn't say that. Before I meet battalion chief, we only texted and then a phone call at the end of the day. When I became a battalion chief, I called her a lot. So our phone calls used to be, if I called her when I was a captain or a firefighter or an engineer, if I called her, that means something was wrong. If I called her before the evening, so she called me on a Sunday, of course, after business hours and nobody's around. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just coming, clearing a run. And she said, I need you to pull over. And I was like, oh man, what's wrong? And she's like, yeah, we're going to go take her and put her on a hold. And so again, I start the cycle of trying to find somebody to come in. This one was a little bit less stressful, but I had the same feeling because I couldn't leave when I wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you do eventually get off of work and, you know, you can actually see your daughter and hug your daughter and whatnot, describe that feeling and then what you did to reconcile when you weren't there. What's the growth? You know, we've talked about, you know, the traumatic side of it. Now, what's the growth side of you and your daughter?
Well, I've switched positions. I'm the chief of training now. This is my third week, and I have a 40-hour position where I'm able to be home every night now. I have a truck, so if I gotta leave work, hey, I can go lights and sirens all the way, you know, till I get home. So, the growth is still something, a work in progress between us. I think being home, she tends to put on a little bit more braver face when I'm home. And so that's what my hope is for her. Obviously, she's still working through some things. Obviously, I'm still working through a couple of things too. And so we're continuing to have our lines of communication open and hanging out. And really the stuff we used to do pre-pandemic, we haven't been able to do. She and I used to go to museums all the time. So, I have three girls. So they all like different things. So I've always kind of separated it. My youngest one likes amusement parks, so she and I have passes and we go to the amusement park. And my middle daughter, she likes museums, so we go to museums. And then my older daughter, she likes the finer things, so we kind of do a little bit of those things. So
hold on one sec, Chief. Let me cut you off there. Yeah. Who's the Martin Lawrence and who's the Will Smith of you when somebody opens the door to take your daughter out on a date?
That happened.
That's awesome. So, were you the Martin Lawrence, and then you had your boy there with you?
I was Will Smith with a durag and a slice beater and.
That's awesome. How old are you, boy? 18, brother. You look 30.
Wait, which daughter was that? One, two, or three? Which daughter was that?
One.
One. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, yeah. Go back to what you were saying, Chia. I'm sorry to cut you off there.
Yeah. So yeah, we our growth is it's just kind of talking with each other, and I don't push. We haven't really talked about the incident. We talked about the event of the incident right after it happened. And then, I think part of her healing process is that, she will talk, actually she doesn't talk about it to me, but I know she talks about it in therapy. So I don't push it. I let our growth, become organic. Every now and again, I'll push a little bit, but not very much, because she's extremely vulnerable, and fragile. So it's something that, it's going to be a long and lasting, thing. And my hope is that she lives a normal life and she's able to function. So, you know, it's based on good days and bad days, and we have a lot of bad days. And so I think part of that, me switching positions and being able to be home, is hopefully is going to help, continue with that growth.
So Chief, you've had, obviously we've talked about lots of traumas on work, at home, involving your family. Have you noticed any changes in yourself or your daughter's activities around home? Any coping mechanisms that you've acquired to help deal with some of the stuff, whether it's conscious or subconsciously?
Oh yeah, more so in me, and I've seen a little bit in her, but I'll talk about me mostly. One of the things, and again, this last year was really rough for me. And for all of us. So what I ended up doing was one of my coping mechanisms, you know, as a chief officer and as a leader in an organization, you have to address problems and you have to be able to manage people. Right. And so, I started having avoidance where, I would have some issues or some personnel problems with a couple of my company officers that were working for me. And I would wait up until the very last moment that I had to talk to these people where I should have talked to them like probably 2 or 3 weeks before that. So it was avoidance, for me. And I ended up in therapy and I kind of go in and out a little bit. And I remember my therapist who was an ex-deputy sheriff and she sees a lot of police and firefighters and she was telling me that she had a fire captain in there, probably the day before I went in. And the captain was complaining about the chief, his battalion chief, saying that, you know, he needs to act on these things. He needs to do something about these problems. And that really resonated with me. So the avoidance that I was doing at work wasn't helping anything. And so once she said that, I really tried to put on a clear conscience to address those problems. And they weren't easy to do for me. It's not easy to talk when, especially when your verbal judo is not very good at the time. And you like that, huh? Yeah, I got that from you. And I always have this saying at work is, you know, if people just spoke Trey, I would be so good on things, you know. And I got a couple of good guys that work for me that really know what it means when I say certain things. I'm not trying to be a jerk about it. Just sometimes I'm stern and I get into I call it my pit bull mode, and I start just kind of get into that thing. And I'll have a couple of guys pull me back. Hey man, you're a little heavy right now. Oh, my bad. So, some avoidance. I put on about 15 pounds. So food was my vice. The good thing about alcohol is if I drink more than like 3 drinks, not only do I get a hangover, but I get palpitations because I'm old. I like bourbon, but it's like a finger, maybe 2 fingers at the most, you know?
Yeah.
But those are my vices. My daughter right now, her thing is, I don't know how to put it. She's a clutter. Like her room is a disaster. And that's part of her coping mechanism. And when I ask her, hey, can you just pick it up just a little bit? And she's like, oh, I don't even see it. It doesn't bother me. I'm like, I don't even want to go in there. It's so bad. but she's so fragile, you know, And, you know, you, in the fire service, everything's got a spot. Everything's got to go a certain place, right? And so, you know, I can't, a lot of times as a chief officer in a small agency, before I became the training chief, we run, I had three different divisions. I had facilities, communications, and the HAZMAT program. And so those divisions don't sleep. And so my email, my phone, everything was going off on my days off. And I never really got to get out of work brain. Mm-hmm. I was always in work brain. And that's something that I learned through the healing process and talking with therapists, is that you got to get out of work brain. And so the training chief, man, nobody calls me when I'm off. So, you know.
Nobody wants to train anyway, so it's all good.
Yeah, right?
That's awesome, Chief. And I catch myself, you know, you've told me or told us many times, hey, call me Trey. And it's just like, it's just a thing, yeah, you know, it's just a thing. So I do apologize for that. I know you want to be called Trey. So Trey, if you have a message to your, it's a two part. You're a message to your own firefighters and a message to the firefighters around the country. What would it be?
We kind of touched on it, but it's really the vulnerability and really getting yourself help. It's okay when the fixers need to be fixed. And, you know, because we're so short staffed and our members are working, man, at one point for probably 3 months, we were so short that, our firefighters and medics were getting forced 8 to 10 times a month. And I spent a lot of my time as the ops battalion chief last year, just talking to guys who had, we call it, it's an M code next to our daily roster. They had a yellow M. I went out there and I talked to them, or I made a phone call, I made a special trip. Sometimes I brought them donuts. You know, if somebody went home in the middle of the shift and we got another, firefighter in, I text them or call them on the way in and tell them, hey, sorry, you got hit today. We appreciate you answering the phone, and when you get here, we're going to take care of you. So really taking care of themselves and that knowing that it's okay, to hurt. But there's options for you. We had, one of our members commit suicide a little over 3 years ago, and it really shook our department up. He was active. And it was the guy that you would never have thought would have committed suicide. His name, I won't say his name, but we called him Big Man, and he was a gentle giant, real quiet dude, but whenever he spoke, it was absolutely classic. I mean, he always said the funniest stuff at the right appropriate time, and it would just leave you in stitches. And so, but he was a really quiet guy, and he's not the guy I would have picked. And there's a handful of guys right now on our department that are pretty close right now, and I've had multiple conversations with them. And so my advice is really it's okay to be open about it. Find somebody that you could confide in and really get that mental health and that well-being for yourself. Take care of yourself. And a lot of them are medics, and we're so short medics that they don't want to give up their cert because there's a fear of screwing their brother or their sister. And I tell them, hey, man, you got to take care of yourself. You're no good to anyone if you're no good to yourself. So that's my biggest advice.
So what about the advice for all the firefighters around the country?
All the firefighters around the country, again, it's okay if you're hurt. It's okay if things bother you. But really, we should find avenues to get help for ourselves. The IAFF has done a phenomenal job with their, I can't think of the name of the center, but they're starting to open up more locations. We're starting to look at mental health in a different aspect. And again, my department, after that suicide, we developed this peer team. We have placards all over the fire stations with numbers to EAP and the names of the peer team members on there. So we really are pushing to heal yourself. And you guys know as well as I do, I think it was in 2017, more firefighters committed suicide than we had light of duty deaths. So my advice to the firefighters around the nation is it's it's okay to get hurt, but fixers need fixing too. And make sure you get help.
That's a beautiful message, Chief. We appreciate that. You're not off the hook just yet. We got something. We got something for you. Let's see how the Chief takes this. It's something called rapid fire. Well, we know that you just click a radio and you don't really go into a fire anymore. So listen. So we got you back in the fire now. So the rule is you have to answer in one word or one phrase. All right. You got that, Trey?
Okay.
All right. Yeah, so Zeph will take over on the questions, and we'll go from there.
All right, Trey. Key word here is rapid, all right? First thing that comes to your mind, all right? First question. What are you the most proud of? And it doesn't have to be your career. It could be in life or your career.
I'm most proud of my daughters. And they're strong Black women, and they are... I got to give my wife a lot of credit for this because, you know, I'm always at work, but I'm most proud of them and what they've become so far at their young ages.
Beautiful.
Second question. What's that song when it comes on the radio that you turn up the volume and roll up the windows because you're embarrassed to be seen listening to it?
Oh, song. You know, I like that French Montana song, Unforgettable. Man, I love that song.
All right.
That makes two of us.
Yeah.
After you dropped a piece of food on the ground, what's the longest it sat before you picked it up and ate it?
I'm not eating food off the floor anymore. Right? I got dogs here, and I got nasty boots at the fire station, so I gave that up a long time ago.
All right. If you could pick yourself and your family up and live in a movie, what movie would that be?
Ooh, what movie? I don't know, some place where there's a fairy tale and a beach. And
is that Moana?
I don't know.
Little Mermaid? What are we talking
Moana?
About?
Moana? Yeah. I don't know, maybe Jurassic. Nah, not
that Jurassic Park. Definitely not Jurassic Park.
No.
Where are we at?
I don't know. You got me, Zeph. I don't know.
All right. I'm going to chop the hook on this one. All right. Last one. One word to describe being a chief.
Ooh. It's tough, man. I'll be honest with you. It's tough. It's not what I thought it would be. And I always tell, I do a lot of mentoring and I tell guys this all the time. If I have to give a class on being a chief officer, it would be what I thought I knew, what I wish I knew, and what I had no idea about. And it's really tough because, and for me, because I was always a guy's guy and a firefighter's firefighter. And I like training. I like going on runs. I like being down and dirty. And I miss that. Man, I can't tell you how much I miss that. And so when you tell me I don't get to go on fires, I do get to go on fires. I can be a division, G. I could be division two on a high rise, you know, or a second story. So
there you go.
That's beautiful. Chief. Thank you again so much for coming on. I mean, just your vulnerability. I mean, you've said vulnerability so many times during this podcast, and that you exude every single aspect of that word, and just your courage around, you know, your daughters. You're definitely a girl dad for sure. And we really, really commend you for coming on and sharing your story. And you were, you know, one of the first ones that came through our website and, you know, reached out to us. So we really appreciate that because that kind of opened up the floodgates to everybody else, you know, after you. So Chief, again, thank you. Thank you so much for your service and your continuing service. And we wish the best with you and your daughter's relationship. And we'd love to have you back on to get the post of, you know, that daughter and dad relationship and maybe have her on next time. I think that would be phenomenal to hear her side of the story. And again, Chief, thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on. And obviously, like G said, I reached out to the channel because it was resonating with me, and I felt that maybe my story would help somebody else.
Absolutely, and that's the goal. That's,
we can just help one. We did our job.
Absolutely. So, again, guys, thank you so much for listening. This is Project Mayday. Call out.